Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
So, overall opinion, if you were offered a position anywhere, Eric, meaning you could take a job in Texas, take a job in California, in terms of a company, right? But you could live wherever you wanted to live. You could stay in Michigan. You could, and I think about this in reference. I had a good friend recently turned down a really awesome position, but the deal was he would have to move to Texas, and that was kind of a deal breaker for him and his family.
Right.
I was thinking about our conversation and the whole remote workforce, being able to work remote. And if you were offered, you know, if there's companies out there offering equal pay for no matter where you live across the board for tech, you know, would you be more considerate of taking job X, Y, or Z if you could still live in Michigan or wherever you wanted to?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Because I think it certainly shifts the decision-making process and looking at a company. For me personally, you know, kind of going back to how we started out, I've got a lot of family here, loving Four Seasons. I don't think I would change away from Michigan, but what I think it does is offer up opportunities. You know, you think about people that have a house up north right now. Maybe that house is somewhere in one of the lower states. Maybe it's sitting out in the East Coast in a less expensive area, that because you can work, that you could work half the year from one place, half the year from another. Granted, kids and school kind of change that equation. But one of the things I think for me is the decision would have to be, it still depends on the company, right? That matters more to me than the work from home. And I know, you know, if we go back and we could go through, I think there was a study that was done on, what are they called? Googlers? Is that what they call their employees? Now, and I think it was kind of asking them and looking at it and getting a breakdown of who would want to stay completely remote, who would want to be in the office. And then there was a large contingent that was sitting in a hybrid situation. And I think for me personally, that's kind of where I sit. I think there's an element that I do like being in person from an efficiency standpoint. I think it's easier to pull people together, make a decision and get running than it is to get everybody on a Zoom, Teams, WebEx call. I don't know. I hate WebEx. So sorry, Cisco. Zoom or Teams.
Yeah. And I think that's, it offers a lot of different opportunities. And I think it lets you set your interested location first, and then where you want to be. And then, you know, as Eric said, you've got a lot of options, both those that are physically local and those that are remote. And the idea, you know, for me, I like working remotely. I've had remote teams around the world for most of my career. So I've never been in the same room as at least 2/3 of my team at any given time, because I've had them in, you know, 8 different time zones.
Inclusive of this team right here.
Exactly. And so not being physically with everybody is not a deal breaker for me. But I think it is a deal breaker for some company cultures. I've had opportunities and I've passed on opportunities where organizations were said, yeah, we want you, you must relocate because our culture insists on everybody being physically together. I mean, if you look at Netflix, Netflix has actually built a culture specifically designed around being in person.
Right.
And they want, and they like it and they want it, and you know, more power to them. But it means that this type of opportunity to remote work or get people from around or have people do the commute. Yeah, I've looked at opportunities where I've been in one place and have commuted. I've done this in some cases where I lived in one country and commuted a couple of days a week or a couple of months out of the year to another place. And those, you know, those worked really well. But I think now companies are finally much better positioned to do this for the first time, to really do this on broad scale and open up the number of people that they have access to outside of their region. This becomes especially interesting in security, where we say we don't, you know, we have pockets of people. People are all happily employed. We don't have enough people to fill the roles that we, the security roles that we have. So let's look wider.
Right.
Now there's a whole host of issues that go along with this that we don't have solutions for, like taxation. Where do you get taxed if you live, if you fake live in one place? You go up to your place, you know, let's say you have a place in Colorado and you live in Michigan and your company you work for is in Michigan, but you disappear to Colorado unbeknownst to your company. You are actually domiciling there. What are the tax implications of that and who's responsible? So it's not, unfortunately, not just as clean and clear cut as the episodes of House Hunters International would like you to believe, that you can just open up the back deck of your new beach place, pull out your MacBook Pro and sit there and decide to work from there for six weeks out of the, you know, out of a quarter, and then just jet back to wherever you were from when you're needed in the office.
Right.
But all that said, I love the prospect that we're actually getting closer.
Yeah, I think it's a good shift. And there, you know, like you were saying, Dan, I think there is going to be a contingent of companies that you get one from a culture standpoint are going to say, we are an in-person company. This is just kind of who we are. And as long as they can articulate, this is why, this is what it brings to the table, this is why it makes us who we are. I get that. But then I think there is going to be a contingent of companies out there that are going to say, well, we are an in-person company, and they really don't know why. And I think a lot of it's going to come down to trepidation around, and we kind of touch on this in episode 14, because they don't know how to handle the metrics on how to track productivity. And because I remember going to the shift earlier this year, and there was a lot of questions around, well, are you going to track people on how much time they're on VPN? Are you going to, you know, how are you going to track that? And for some reason, there are a lot of managers out there that didn't understand that tracking a person in the office or out of the office, by and large, if you have good defined metrics, doesn't fundamentally change. Now, I'm sure there's somebody could throw out some nuance there and something that the remote does change some element a little bit. But, you know, you think about like a call center, right? A call center is all based on how quickly you pick up a call, how many calls are dropped, don't go or go to a voicemail, how many rings and all of that. It doesn't matter where you are. We can plug in phones from anywhere and connect them. And those metrics stay the same. Same thing from IT standpoint, security standpoint, whether you're tracking on tickets closed, projects completed, it's, none of those metrics are based on locale. It's
right.
It's all based on the element and you're trying to track.
Right. But in, and then layer onto that, the tools to do so. Earlier this year, a couple of months ago, Microsoft's always had in Office 365 this analytics feature, which will show you your own productivity. And this is audio, so you can't see me doing the air quotes, in which you see how much engagement there is in mail and chat and all of these Microsoft-based features. Meetings and how many times you're in, who you interact with most, what files you use. It's all, you know, it perhaps interesting stuff to you. But during this was actually just a month ago, it was the beginning of December, late November, they rolled out a new productivity score, which was given to managers to help assess how much people were engaged in the work they were doing. It came under the guise of, you know, trying to manage employee productivity. But what it also did was create environments for, you know, privacy challenges, because not every part of the world has the same expectation or lack of expectation of privacy while you're in the workplace. It included employee names. It was very heavy-handed and not opt-in. And so Microsoft ended up getting huge backlash and pulling back on this. But I think it was rooted in the mindset of trying to support that if I can't see you, I can't manage you, my traditional working mindset, which is not one that will be good to support in this new, you know, in this new working model. So, you know, I'm pleased to see that that was changed, but it doesn't mean that managers aren't still thinking in the physical realm in this new virtual and perhaps longer term virtual realm.
Right. It'll be. Go ahead. Go ahead, Brian. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I was thinking about this in terms of my previous travel life when I was traveling, you know, 150 to 200 days out of the year. And I had said to the wife that, yeah, I go, but when I was working at that company, it had to be in person. Like we had to be in the office. It was one, the culture, and two, the responsibility of managing and teaching people. And the more I sat back and thought about that after making the comment that it had to be that way, I could have lived anywhere in the country and technically just flown to the office 2 to 3 times a month in any one of the trips I was already on. It didn't really matter because I was only going to the office maybe 3 or 4 days out of the month with the amount of travel I was doing, right?
Yep.
Everything I was doing was pretty much working remote from an airplane, from a hotel, from anywhere in the world, right? So, yeah. And I look at, you know, if they say, well, you can't be remote, you have to be in the office. If the job has any bit of travel associated with it, to be able to go to that office once a month, right? I guess there's old, obviously different jobs, job requirements, different verticals that people are going to work in. Obviously, if you're a line worker in manufacturing, you pretty much have to be local. You have to be present on the line to work.
Right.
But in the context, when we were talking about security and tech jobs, could that job be done remotely if the organization was up to it? And I think it opens up, Eric, when we were talking earlier and you mentioned going up north, I was thinking about real estate too. Commercially, you know, there's like, well, commercial real estate is going to feel the squeeze, but what about property ownership? You know, now people could say, instead of having one large house, we could have 2 small homes and we could spend our summers up north or our summers down south, you know, and take the family when the kids are out of school or just go up whenever we wanted to, right? Because
and
we could work
in virtual school. And with virtual school, Brian, that boundary doesn't even exist. It's, hey, let's go spend the next 3 months down there. Now we're back to what school district am I in and how, you know, those kind of things. But right now I know people that are literally picking up with their kids and going to a far flung destination and holding up there for 4, 5, 6 months. And none of it matters. No one even knows that they've gone except for the people they've told.
Right. I like the parallel you drew on that one, Brian, because I think a lot of companies didn't put the 2 and 2 together. And when they said, well, we're in person, but wait, I'm traveling. You know, if I think back to last year, you know, I was in London for a while. I was in Italy. I was in Germany. And as I moved around, it didn't matter where I was still connected. You just shift your hours so that you still got coverage across the different time zones, but you're still working, whether you're from a plane, a hotel, or in the office. It really doesn't change much other than you can walk into my office and have a conversation with me.
But to take the flip side, and as someone who has spent large amounts of time on the road as well, there is something to be said for those hallway conversations that you miss by not being physically present. And those I haven't yet seen a good recreation of in technology. You pass somebody on your way to the bathroom. You happen to be walking by and you see them in their office and you pop your head in. Those kind of things I have not seen take place in virtual worlds nearly as much, and especially during COVID, because it's a far more conscious activity. And if you're in a company in which decisions are made at, let's say, headquarters, and you happen to be at the headquarters, but you're traveling, conversation happens in the hallway, the decision gets made, you're not there part of it, you now live with it. I mean, it's a little bit of FOMO, it's a little bit of fear of missing out, but at the same time, there are some real dynamics that take place in the place where the decisions are being made.
True.
And the travel culture, and even more so the fully remote culture, that doesn't happen, especially if 80% of the people are in person and some small percentage are not.
There's a quote from my previous president. He used to always say, out of sight, out of mind. And it was a culture issue with when you talk about big organizations that have different locations around the globe. If you didn't make yourself present at least 4 to 5 times at the global headquarters overseas, you are out of sight, out of mind.
Meaning, 100% agree.
Yeah. So I still think no matter if you're remote or not, you're still going to make yourself present at different times. But there's a lot of truth to the people that are there in that inner circle, seeing each other every day, that run into each other at the water cooler and say, hey, well, that's a good point. Why don't we grab lunch and talk about it? Right. There's those inner circles. Right. And you notice people move up the chain and you see that in large corporations. So I think there's some of that could be lost or will be lost with that style of remote work.
To take the counter to that, though, if we look at some of the bigger companies, look at some of the bigger tech companies that have done remote offices. You know, if you take a Facebook, a Google, an Amazon, all of those have offices all over the world, but somehow they still find those people to move them around. They aren't necessarily back at the world global headquarters, right?
But that requires a conscious activity to do so. And this comes back to the culture of the organization.
Right.
A culture of an organization that is built around we are headquarters and there's other things that go on and we don't really care about them. And there's a lot of those types of companies. Those people are going to get forgotten. But if you're making conscious decisions, and this is why you need to, when you're making these kind of decisions about where to work, and if you want to be part of a remote lifestyle, you kind of got to understand those dynamics before going in. And it's hard if you haven't already been there. But if it's a place in which decisions are being made that way, or versus being consciously aware of remote locations, or there's four or five key locations and those are where decisions are made and they collaborate well amongst each other, then you're going to have a much better chance of success in being remote at those times,
right?
At those places.
I think it's interesting because I really think that you're going to see a lot of companies that are going to, lack of better terms, update their culture based on this. And being able to adapt. And granted, there's going to be that whole contingent that don't, and the talent pool is going to be tougher and become scarcer. But I become interested and I was thinking about this, throwing this out, chicken or the egg, right? I'm going to pick on California. Look at some of the companies that are out there. That if you take some of the big tech companies that are pulling from local resources, local people out there, by and large, I think if we look from a political view, California, I would consider fairly homogenous, right? You have different pockets that might lean to a different political leaning. But by and large, I think as we look at big tech, you get a fairly homogenous group within, I'll call the Facebooks, the Googles, and some of those. Mm-hmm. As those shift to pulling resources, pulling people that no longer have to be there, they are no longer local to California, do we see those cultures start to change? Because and this is where it gets into the chicken or the egg, right? Do you gravitate towards that area because you hold a certain political ideal and that becomes a fit? Or, there is a contingent that when you are with a group, there is a large amount of people that become chameleons and you it's the Borg, you assimilate. And if you're pulling people from all over, creating what should be a more diverse population of employees, do we start seeing some of those cultures change over time?
That's a really good, that's a point I hadn't thought about. In everything, culture change, especially in an organization or even in society, is truly evolutionary. It's not revolutionary. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to happen a long, slow, glacial evolution. But yeah, as you're getting those kind of influences, or as people are getting local, more of their local influences spread around a country or around a world and bringing those as part of the overall culture, do you get a more balanced, company? Or is it set by leadership, the leadership of the organization? And, if you just think about the culture, if you take the political culture out of it, just have a, what is our working culture? What is our interaction culture? It's usually set the tone from the top. It's set by the four or five or six people at the top. They set they have their working style. And you tend to see that prevail through and down the organization. I wonder if this will be, if those other areas will also follow in that. And that's where the leadership sets the tone for the organization in those topics as well. I don't know.
It'll be interesting to watch. I go back to Brian, your original question that you kind of pointed at me. I think what it does open up is there are other companies that people will start looking at to potentially join on. As I go back, and since I've been consistently on California now, as I look at California, to me, I think there's cool pockets. It is a great state. It's just not a great fit for me. Certain areas are expensive depending on where some of the technology companies are. not something that I'd be interested in picking up and moving to. But as you start to look at some of those companies that are headquartered there, and if they start to turn outwards and say, all right, well, it doesn't matter where you live. So now the requirement to move back to, you know, we're talking about moving to Denver, Chicago, New York, some of those really expensive areas. If that requirement gets lifted, that does change the ballgame a little bit and opens up the gamut of who you could potentially choose for a company or, you know, where you might be willing to work.
So one thing I wanted to throw out there, because it comes up a lot in regards to tech in Silicon Valley, Santa Clara, you know, there's all these great companies that have been created during even the dot-com era. But if you go back and look at what made Silicon Valley tick, and it stems from land grants being offered from Stanford University to try to attract companies to produce tech. But it was the idea of manufacturing. Climate was great. So you had drier air, warmer weather. So it was good for producing what could be considered, you know, microprocessors that weren't even being made yet. But Silicon Valley, its biggest product or production was actually almonds and peaches. It wasn't until the silicon transistor was invented. And the gentleman who had won the Nobel Prize for creating the first transistor and then going to make the silicon transistor brought a team out. One of those guys was Bob Noyce. Now, when that team tried to tell the company on the East Coast that owned them that, listen, we need to be going in this direction, they said, nope, it's his way or the highway. And they all got together, had breakfast, and they were trying to convince Noyce to leave that company with them, that they couldn't do it without him. And you know what his response was? Why would I do that? People don't leave companies. We can't do that. We'll be shunned, right? Thus started the era where people took chances and left. They convinced him that they needed him because he was a well-spoken, he could explain to investors or other people, and they all signed a dollar bill and left. And they went and started another company with backing from another East Coast company. And again, over the years, all the profit when they invented them, the silicon microprocessor, then at this point, or they did the silicon transistor, then the microprocessor, all the money in this company was basically coming out of their business. In that time, when he pushed back and said, well, we need to pay our people more. We need to give these people more money, or we need to give them this, or we need to give them that. And they said, no, read the handbook. The handbook says that they are a level two manager and they get this size desk with that size shoe and a one cup of coffee, right? And they were like, you got to be kidding me. And they're pushing back to Philadelphia saying, you don't get it. And in that time, 90 plus companies have been created that are all descendants of Bob Noyce. The East Coast pushed the idea of people to get up and change jobs constantly because they had their thumb on them and said, well, this is the way it has to be, thus creating this culture. But because of the microprocessor and the production that was created there led to the ability to produce these bigger and better computers and computation, it led to a tech boom, which is why they say, well, that's where tech comes from. It was manufacturing that drove it, right? And just like what made the state of Michigan so great at one point was the manufacturing. And I know for all the listeners out there, that guy always pivots back to automotive, but it was automotive, right? And manufacturing. So I look at the idea when we say tech, homogenous, this and that. Yes, a lot of people wanted to jump and move out there because there was a tech boom, right? And they wanted to be out there because they wanted to be a part of something great and something new. And that's what they wanted to experience because that's where it was happening. It stemmed from this great manufacturing and people being able to take chances. And those seven pioneers did that by leaving a company. And today people leave companies out there all the time. You look at the resumes out there, it's like, oh, I worked at this startup, this one, this one, this one, this one. And it's every 2 years. What I'm getting at is the conversation around what if you didn't have to move all the way out there? Because where did Bob Noyce come from? And if I remember correctly, I think it was Iowa. It might've been Kansas. Can't remember. Don't quote me on that one. But now you could be in any state with a great education and say, I do want to work for that company. Could I work from here or could I work from there? Right? Like, and then I'm going to pivot real quick and say, remember the Pure Michigan commercials? What if there was a commercial with a guy sitting at the top of the Sleeping Beer sand dunes in a chair on his computer? And it says, Pure Michigan. you know, like my work from home day, Monday and Tuesday, this is home. You know, you could be anywhere you want. And I just, I don't know. I throw it out there because I look at Michigan as a big manufacturing state, and there's a pivot right now. I did not just use that word. I did. It's not a pivot. There is a transformation occurring around tech and data and what these vehicles are going to be able to do in the future. And we need people. We need people badly to come and be part of that. And you don't, you can, you could be a grad student down in Texas, or, you know, a PhD student, or just a really good techie from Kansas, or maybe you grew up in the same hometown in Iowa and in Burlington where Robert Noyce is from. You know what I mean? There's, you could come from anywhere and maybe stay there and be part of something great.
We'd like to let everybody know that Brian has just now, in the last 5 minutes, joined the tourism board and the staffing board for the state of Michigan. No, not really. I mean, your point is really well made, Brian. You know, this is, we can do so much. We can do so much more and get so many better people and so many more people if we don't have to include a pretty tumultuous event such as relocation. I'm 7 years removed from my last relocation, and it's still fresh in the minds of the people I dragged with me. It was not an inconsequential event. It was, you know, pretty impactful, especially on partners, kids, trying to figure out in a new place, you know, who to call for to get your air conditioning fixed, you know, all of those kinds of things that go along with it that are, you know, much easier for the person making the move and not so much for the people that support them, the people that are around them, the people that they live with every day, because, you know, you come in and the HR team says, all right, you know, welcome to this company, welcome to this new location. Here are all the resources for you to get settled.
Not
so much for the family anymore.
Not to mention, it's got to be tough wearing Badger apparel in a Wolverine state.
Honestly, it really doesn't matter as much as long as it isn't Ohio State stuff. That's where seem to really get eggs thrown at you living in Ann Arbor,
we'll,
Michigan.
We'll accept you. Just don't. No more Blackhawks. We can't do that one. No.
Hey, we're in this. Blackhawks and the Red Wings are in the same. Conference this year.
So two things. So definitely good points, and definitely agree as we're pulling talent from everywhere. I think the pool opens wider. The ability to pull a more diverse populace to get that diversity of thought and everything definitely expands. You know, I'll throw out there though, does that really work? You know, we've covered startups before and small businesses. Does that model still work though for startups? Because I you know, as we look at early on companies, I think there's still got to be a requirement to be in purpose or be in purpose to be in person. And the same time, actually, the other one I was going to throw out is I'd like to propose a game as part of this. And Brian was mentioning about going tangential again. Yeah, not a drinking game, but for our listeners, throw Dan a topic or a parallel topic or parallel vertical or area, and we'll save it until we get onto the show with Brian, and then we'll release it on the show, and Brian's going to have to draw a parallel story from that topic that was given and tie it back to security. We'll see how good he
about
is.
The orange tell us about the orange growing process in Florida and how it relates to information security, Brian.
That's an interesting one, because most people probably don't even realize, too, like all your orange juice throughout the period of a year when they freeze that, right? All those oranges as they freeze. And this is also something interesting, too. There's a large automotive company out there that actually has a very large holdings, right, in orange growing. I actually had a buddy that tried pitching that internally to our president, and it's a Japanese company that has a holdings in orange juice. But from a security standpoint, if you look at where they store all of that orange juice, right, and you talk about the level of pulp, right, and when they say concentrate, like when you buy orange juice concentrate and then try to mix it up, right, there's literally, I don't want to get this wrong, they'll cut different sections out, like blending it together, almost like when you're doing like a blended whiskey, right? Now, if there was any, and granted these are refrigerators, any type of bacteria located, that could hurt the entire concentration of orange juice. Yes or no? Maybe.
Probably.
And I don't want to pivot too hard on the whole orange juice conversation, but I think this pivots to our last show that we had. If something got in there and contaminated the orange juice after inspection and now is sent out nationwide and people got tainted orange juice, or maybe the pulp free had pulp in it.
Tell you what, if this was a video right now, this is where we'd be doing a cutaway to Dan and I bowing, and like the Wayne's World, we're not worthy.
Brian Schneebly, analogy monster. We've created it, and now we're feeding it.
That's epic. That's epic.
It's great because people say fresh squeeze orange juice, and the reality is most of that orange juice is all kept frozen, right? Like they squeeze it all, freeze it, and then they partition it out. Like this is the really sour, but anyways.
To bring this back, my apologies there. So the idea came from, Brian mentioned about people that gravitate towards the tech boom, right? And the tech boom, we're usually talking about startups. And there was a lot of talk for a while that Detroit started, we started seeing a bunch of incubators. There was a bunch of VC money that was going into it. There were a lot of small companies that were starting up. I don't know if you can do that with a remote culture. I think it's got to start from an in-person.
I don't know. I disagree. There are going to be cases, and again, I think it depends on the people. And I got a new soundboard, and I'm gonna program it. And it depends, button with sound, and you know, and some kind of animation. But I mean, it really does depend upon the people. There are people, I'm collaborating with people around the country that, well, even look at the three of us. We've done this. We've been in the same room prior to COVID, but we've done this entire show, 15 episodes in, and we've not been in the same room. We've done it all through text because we have the right communication style and culture to be able to do so. I think you can do that in startups as well, because if you use good communications, if you have ways to keep the communications open, maybe recreate some of the essence of being in person, even if you're across the country, you can still make it happen. Doing it asynchronously is much more difficult, but if you can do it synchronously, but not physically together, I think that's totally doable.
Fair enough. And I mean, using the podcast as an example, though, I mean, I'll throw out there, the catalyst for all of this was an in-person relationship where we all kind of talked through some of this. That became kind of the bedrock, the foundation that because the relationship existed, then we could transition to outline online and this was no problem. Can you facilitate really creating a relationship purely online? It's like going back to the girlfriend, boyfriend, pen pal. Oh, we'll still be together even though we're 5 hours apart writing each other.
Right. But I think also usually, I don't want to use the word usually. Let's say a group of people, like we wouldn't have met necessarily just online and decided to put together a podcast, right? It came from an actual in-person meeting where we were all together and having a similar conversation and debate at the table. And I think if you were to say that to have a startup, would it be common in this type of work from home environment to get five random people together? I'd probably say no. But if it was five people that had all worked together, not necessarily at the same location, but in the same industry, be it say security, right? You met at an RSA conference or somewhere else, and you've attended somebody else's speeches, you've read their papers, you've gotten together for drinks or maybe dinner while you were traveling at one of these events, and you've talked about maybe some of the pros or cons or maybe some of the deficiencies of a certain product. And over a 2-year period of time remotely, you say, we should get together and do that. You know, it reminds me of the CEO from Zscaler. And I've read, you know, several different bios and several of his different write-ups on some of the startups he created. You know, he not born and raised in Cincinnati, but grew up in Cincinnati, went to school there, you know, went to the university there in Cincinnati. He didn't necessarily grow up there. But he read about what other companies had done and he was fascinated with it and decided he was going to do a startup, right? And if one of his mottos was, if you find good people, you hire them and then find a position for them instead of having a position and then going out trying to find them. If you meet someone that's really good at something and you know that, and he says, I'd love to work with you, you say, yes, that's great. We're going to have you.
Well, that goes back, and we've talked about that before, right? You know, if you look at the mentalities, and I think we all agreed on it, that you hire the soft skills, teach the technical, right? You want to hire somebody for their personalities, all of the other technical components, we can teach that. And I think that goes to exactly what you're talking about, Brian. Now, I think as we look at using video, Zoom, you know, back to WebEx for those that use it, boo. I'm just going to keep taking shots. So sorry, Cisco. So using video, I think it becomes a bit easier to start building that initial trust, building that understanding of a person to I can see you, I can see the non-verbal cues. So that gets it a little bit better. I think it's made it a little bit easier now that this is fairly ubiquitous, but doing it remotely, I think it does take a little bit longer. It's harder to build trust. I think there's a lot of a big underpinning of trust that's built and being in person. Not to saying it's insurmountable doing it in a remote environment, but I think it takes longer.
So I'll put, there's nuance to your original point then. It's the ability to create a startup from two people matched on the eHarmony of startups that have never met and have never worked or collaborated together, versus we happen to be geographically diverse, but we know each other and are already somewhere along the way in knowing how each other work and think it's a good idea. And I agree, the first one is a lot harder if you don't have the basis for working together and have an idea that you're going to be able to work in that remote model in a startup when you need to be all up in each other's business all the time as you bootstrap and get something going.
Right. I agree with Brian. Brian just hit us up on the chat, and I think Dan, you're onto our $1 million idea. We're going to create a match company for VCs and entrepreneurs.
Algorithmic, because algorithms are never wrong.
Never.
But Eric, to your point though, the speed of trust, like it makes business move faster, makes all things move forward. You know, if you're a startup, you know, why do deals get done, you know, overnight between these two companies, but take years for these companies? There's a level of trust between the leaders of those companies and the people that work for them. Yeah. So I definitely would agree with you there.
Dan's point though, you can speed that up with a catalyst. It depends on who's putting that match together. You know, you bring up and kind of ingest in eHarmony, but people trust in eHarmony. Therefore, there is an element of initial trust that comes in because eHarmony knows that, hey, something about the two of us brings us together. And if you have that catalyst that brings kind of those components together, I could certainly see that shortcutting some of the trust road.
Because the guy very trustworthy.
Yeah, and I think if you put Dan's name with the eHarmony for startups, it begins with that very high level of trust, right? And then he's got the voice for it as well. And that's why Dan does our intros. He definitely has that voice for it. I see a great business idea here for startups. And then we pair that with Pure Michigan.
But so let's come back to the speed to trust though, because I think this is important as we go to this, as we move to this remote work, this remote lifestyle. Even in the places where I've had remote teams, I still have physically gone there. And when, or let's say I've done acquisitions, people I'm meeting for the first time, and you sit in a meeting room all day the first day, and it's, I don't know you, you're sort of staring at each other across the table. And then when do the relationships get built? They get built that night when you all go out for dinner. That is when you learn about people as humans, as their lives, their families, their interests. You share beer and you break bread together. And that is where the relationships truly turn into something. And then you leave and you have now a much stronger baseline for the remote communications. So I think binary is not, there's no binary answer of fully remote all the time, never see anybody. It can be done. It's just, it's going to be a lot harder and have to be a lot more conscious, but there are ways to ease it along the way. In terms of, you know, finding ways to build bonds, and some of that can be done through technology too. Right. I had one case where we had Tanberg units well, now Cisco units, that were open between rooms. They were always on, connected over the internal network, and you'd walk into a room at the like the 7 or 8 different locations, and you'd walk into the room and they would be connected to the other locations. And if you said, hey, let's meet for coffee, and the other person would go, and then you had a webcam and a screen, and you would see them right away, and you could both walk into the room and you sort of share and have that time together. And that worked really well, you know, as an alternative, a virtual cup of coffee. Those worked really well to overcome some of those things, and using video, and you know, it really is a big equalizer.
Yeah, certainly. To go back and amend my original statement, not insurmountable, but certainly there's got to be some catalyst, right? There's got to be some mutual element of trust to build off of. And actually, it just kind of hit me thinking back to the book that I recommended to you guys. Was it last week, 2 weeks ago, $1 Trillion Coach. And it was kind of going through Bill Campbell. And the guy is absolutely amazing. If you go through his history and all of the big companies he touched, but there's a story that resonates, that so many prominent people trusted Bill that if Bill trusted somebody else, it became implicit trust. Because A trusts B there and B trusts C, therefore A must trust C.
By the transitive property.
Right. Yeah. So it definitely exists, and there's certain people that have that potential to bring together some of those startups.
Speaking of startups, speaking of, you know, Silicon Valley, speaking of Detroit, if you could get the same pay for the job position that was in, let's say, Silicon Valley, Santa Clara, San Jose, San Francisco, in, let's say, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Detroit, Michigan, Cincinnati, Ohio, where would you take the position? And I think it's twofold. I'm throwing out areas local to, I can't even say all of our listeners, but to where we live, right? And if you look at the pay difference, right, let's say, well, if you were in Silicon Valley, we pay you 3x because of the cost of living, taxes, property value, you know, blah, blah, blah. But if you're going to live in Michigan, here's your pay because it's equal to the area you're living in or moving to. But if that pay was to be equal to what you would get in California, I think a lot of people, and not specific California, but different areas within California, I think a lot of people would look at that and say, my money's going to go a lot further, maybe in a smaller area in Indiana or Ohio or Michigan.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And, you know, to me, I see that as company marketing. I think over the short run, sure. I think they're going to move that, incentivize people to get out of those expensive cities. And then at some point, there's going to be they're going to run the analysis and like, all right, most of our employees are no longer in those high cost areas. Why am I paying the high cost wages? And it's going to shift down. It'll be self-correcting over time.
I think there will be companies like that. But all along, if you look at companies like 37 Signals, which is now Basecamp, they've always had Basecamp and a few other products. They rebranded recently to just focus on Basecamp. Their founders, Jason Fried and David Heinemeier Hansen, they've been adamant about equal pay. They have a mostly virtual team. They're based out of Chicago, but they pay everybody in the company that at a certain job, in a certain title, they pay them the same wages as they would if they were in Chicago, no matter where they are. And they've been really focused on this, and they're very talent focused. So I think there's going to be an opportunity for leading companies that want to attract talent, that want to retain talent, and want to get the most diverse spread of people around the company. And if they really, truly want to solve their talent woes, this is a way to do it. It's a way to get people interested, to get people paid well. I know people here in Ann Arbor that work for California companies and take California salaries and live a wonderful life. And then we have not seen the California companies change those salary rates, but agreed, Eric, it is always a possibility, especially as people start to look at, well, where can we, you know, it's going to be companies that are that are beholden to Wall Street or beholden to investors to look for, you know, the most cap and the most profit potential. But I think it's an opportunity, again, another differentiator that you can use when trying to figure out what the company is that you want to go to next. Is this something that allows you to earn a good living no matter where you live and be confident that they're not, that they, you know, that this is a fundamental ethos of their organization?
So I agree with you that allows companies to be more competitive, but I really don't think it's anything about location at that point. I think it's just a company being competitive. It's no different than you look at, you know, a lot of people jump on the bandwagon that there's how much CEOs make. And granted, that can be highly politicized, highly energized. But if you look at it, and if you look at the people that are CEOs, it's a finite group, right? There's only so many people that can actually are qualified to do that job. So what happens? That if I as a company need to attract a new CEO, I now have to pay them more than where they're at. I have to give them some incentive to draw them out.
Right.
And I think at some point it becomes less about location, that we stop caring about that. All right, to use like the government analogy, that you have, you know, you have the pay band plus X percentage based on location, and it just purely becomes a competitive that I'm just going to pay more because I want to attract that person away from some of the bigger companies. I think transitioning and saying that, oh, well, we're paying the same thing at every location. Sure, I think that sounds good, but all you're trying to do is be a more competitive company.
Right, but why wouldn't that? But then the question is, why wouldn't that persist? You know, you made the initial assessment that it was marketing. In many cases, it would be seen as a marketing opportunity. What you just described is also marketing to some extent, but it's at some point, if you stop it, you then will lose the talent that you have that you've needed. And you won't be able to continue to attract them. Why wouldn't it be, you know, what's the reason that might not persist? Or do you think it would be continuous that it would never persist?
I don't think it's going to persist, because I think as you start to boil it down, there's an element that comes down to just looking at it from a logical standpoint. I think that's where it'll end up transitioning. That somebody is going to run the statistics at some point, and then whether it be kind of market influence on that, we need to focus on the bottom line. Therefore, that's where we're going to focus our effort or whatever. I think it'll shift down. Now, I'm not saying there won't be those companies that will pay that top dollar in perpetuity. Yes, those are going to exist, and there's some amazing leaders out there. Not knowing a whole lot about the, and I apologize, Dan, I forget the company that you mentioned.
Basecamp.
You know, I'm sure that there's a lot of that just stems from the culture of who they are as leaders. And they are probably focused more on the employee and what the employee is worth rather than employees being numbers and just figuring out the lowest cost to get operations maximized where they need them.
Right. But that's when marketing becomes true draw for talent. It may start out as it starts out in your heart, or maybe it starts out as an interesting marketing endeavor to get talent to come. But if it works, why not stay with it?
So why does Intel exist today? Because somebody said they weren't worth the money to pay them, and they moved on and created their own business. I do agree that it's marketing and you're incentivizing, et cetera. But if you want to create something great here, right? If you want to attract tech, you know, to the state of Michigan or Ohio or Indiana or Ontario, right? It does start with saying, okay, you do deserve the same pay that you would get paid to be out at this position out here. And you do that. And then the second you say that, well, now we've looked at it from the bottom line, the bean counters got together and guess what? We're going to go ahead and reduce that pay down. All those people are going to leave and go start up something great. Great. As long as they've created families here, they're going to keep starting something great. And that's what happened out there. 90 plus companies are descendants of working under noise because somebody out in the East Coast wasn't willing to pay them what they deserve.
Right. Well, in that case, I would actually argue that you end up we just came through a census, right? You do a shifting of the population, and then you might create certain new population centers. Here's my biggest concern. And I like Basecamp and what they're doing. I like setting the higher wage, but if you start getting too many companies on board with that and just drawing a parallel, and I don't even know if I myself believe this, but I'm going to throw it out there anyways, do you end up becoming like our sports? That's the sports. The number one pick usually, and I think this, I know it applies in basketball and I'm sure it applies in other sports, gets paid more than the current highest paid athlete, right? Do you end up creating that and it becomes an unsustainable model in businesses of one-upmanship?
It's a very good point. But the idea of, if you were to try to apply the idea of market value, I don't know. You make,
they do the same thing in basketball. They say, well, look at the market value.
Exactly. You know? What does it take to keep this person? And it's higher and it's one up. And then the next team comes and goes one higher the next year. And then you end up with baseball pitcher salaries of $184 million over 5 years, and ticket prices at $180 for the bleachers at Wrigley.
And to be honest, I am saying CISOs are worth that. So feel free to put this into that category.
Feel free to one up me. Yeah.
I think it goes back to the Zen master, and we'll see. You know, little boy falls off a horse, breaks his leg. Oh, how bad for the boy? We'll see. You know, the whole village goes off to war. Everybody dies, but the boy had a broken leg. Oh, how lucky for the boy? We'll see. You know, yeah, you pay him these wages. You know, what's going to happen? It can't just keep climbing exponentially, but at some point you got to create a little bit of incentive and show people really how great, in personal opinion, how great Michigan is. Like, yes, right now I am advocating for people to move to the state of Michigan. I think it's great. Four seasons, boating. You have a thing called a place called the UP, otherwise UP or the Upper Peninsula. There's a lot of great, cool stuff in Michigan to do. And from a tech side, if you could do tech anywhere, and you got what's this transition in automotive with autonomy and electrification happening, I think it's great. And there's going to be a lot of security needed around the vehicle architecture, the V2X, right? Vehicle to vehicle communication, vehicle to infrastructure communication. And I would hate to see another location somewhere else in the US, you know, maybe central US, where people come together and say, well, we can do that here, we can do that there. And we miss that opportunity, right? Some of the things that we did great that we were known for, and it's not the Detroit Lions, they've never been great. But
I'm still holding out hope.
Some of the first paved roads, right? Some of the first traffic lights, right? You have Woodward. And those were first when it came to building infrastructure for vehicles. The future infrastructure, though, is going to have a lot of tech, a lot of technology. And the corridor between Ann Arbor and Detroit that they talked about building is kind of a first step to say, look what they're doing, and let's get people to come, whether it's Grand Rapids, Ann Arbor, Detroit, maybe it's Auburn Hills, or maybe it's someplace I haven't even heard of yet.
So does some of this virtualization put the nuance and interestingness of localities at risk? To look at this from the other side, all the things you talked about are attractants to a place. But if going to a job, the reason many people end up where they end up, either their parents lived there and they stayed nearby, or they went to school there and they stayed nearby, or a job brought them there. If the job brought them there goes by the wayside, do we lose the ability to draw people to an area, and do we end up losing mobility that gets people exposed to new areas and new experiences, because now jobs are ubiquitous and I can sit in this red chair in this room in Ann Arbor, Michigan, all day, every day for the rest of my career?
And there was a moment of silence there. I
begin to wonder. So I agree with you, Dan, that there, the potential of that, but playing off of what Brian is talking about in the evolution of technology specific to the auto market, I almost wonder if that makes us here in Michigan, it may not affect us the same way, right? A huge component of automotive is manufacturing.
Right. And right? I'm talking about it even beyond just Michigan, just, you know, this locality. But in general, you know, what draws people to Provo, Utah? Novell was there. And, you know,
right.
that may be a huge thing that, I don't know, I just picked a city. be a thing that drew people there. If the relocation of people to Provo for work stops, does it put Provo at risk?
Well, I think certain areas will be at risk. And I think those certain areas where their chief export is something that is non-tangible. When you get into non-tangible, that I create a software, I create a website, anything that I create like that, I can do from anywhere. But as you get back to kind of core America, core American manufacturing is still an in-person thing. So I think as we start looking at those areas where those elements are still happening, I would imagine you still see the influx. And certainly as we look at Michigan and what automotive is doing right now, I think there's going to be a huge influx of, and there certainly is a need for specifically within security, within engineers, pulling people in as we see the shift to new technology in our cars.
Yep, absolutely. And as we're coming upon the hour, I'll close with an article that was in the New York Times two days ago. The title is California May Lose, it's an opinion piece. California may lose some of its stars, but Silicon Valley is forever. You know, the idea that people are leaving Silicon Valley in droves because of the ability to work remotely, because of, you know, some of these equal pay initiatives around the country, or taking California pay and enjoying a really great lifestyle in Montana. But the idea of what Silicon Valley is about will likely persist beyond those people, for better or for worse. And I think that it's an interesting food for thought, and I'll put the link into the show notes, because I think it's a really good piece that talks about, you know, the idea that some of this will overcome, the idea of the ethos here, the automotive industry. There's more to this area than just the idea of automotive. It's the work that happens. It's the people that happens, and whether people come or go, or whether companies draw people here or not, or physically or not, the idea of what Detroit is will remain. The idea of what Silicon Valley is will remain. So with that, we're going to close for today. Brian, Eric, thanks again for a great security debate. Mostly not security, but a lot of tech and a lot of employment stuff, which I know this is a topic that a lot of people are talking about and a lot of people are interested in as we settle in for what could be another 6, 9, 12 months of remote work for some people and some of the decision points that come along their way. Thanks to everybody for listening. Really appreciate your feedback and ideas. Please email us feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net with any ideas, thoughts, topics for next conversations, or feedback. Our website is www.greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can find us on Twitter @securitydebate. If you get a moment, please go to your favorite podcast app and subscribe to the app. Leave some feedback there, put a rating. It helps us out a lot and gets the show a little bit more discovery when people go and search for it in those applications. Thanks so much, and we'll see you again on another Great Security Debate.